Hello, how's it going? It's Matthew here from the future. I haven't really done this before, but was just chatting to Neil at the end of our conversation today, and we thought it was a good idea to do this. We'd just like to give a little cautionary warning that some of the things we discuss in today's episode may be difficult to hear based on your own personal experience. Some of the things we talk about today include acts of terror, abuse, child abuse, sexual abuse, along with some explicit reference to health and medical issues. It's done in a sensitive way, and there's some really, really insightful pieces of advice and coping mechanisms that Neil talks about, but we did just want to be upfront and honest at the beginning of the episode so that you can decide whether or not you feel it is right for you to continue. Okay, that's it. Going to roll straight into the raw audio that we recorded on the 6th of January, 2021, starting with Neil's first memory.
My first memory is falling down the stairs in the first house that my parents lived in Glengormley, which is where I was brought up. And I've got a really clear view of, I was trying to close the curtains, and I think I remember my mum saying, "Stop doing that," or some sort of similarly toned advice, which hasn't really changed over the years. And as I reached forward, I still remember reaching forward, trying to get it to move, using my left hand. And the next thing, I go tumbling down the stairs with the with the fairly appropriate feedback that I received for doing that. I'm not sure if I can swear in this, so I won't.
Do you know what? Like, work away, especially if you put on your mum's accent. Everything's permissible.
There's always a risk that she hears this, so I don't want... So thanks, mum.
Yeah, I know. That's the thing. Shout out to our parents. You know, every time we have conversations like this, we say, look, you know, you did us well. So yeah, look, if you've just jumped in to the kind of random place where we are. Hello and welcome. This is Best of Belfast. This is a podcast that celebrates Northern Ireland and the incredible people in it. You've just heard the first memory of Neil Walsh. And a little bit about Neil, just to set a bit of context before we keep going. Neil is the chief of the cybercrime, counter-terrorist finance and anti-money laundering department at the United Nations. He's got staff in six continents. Him and his team, they basically aid preventive diplomacy and aid the UN senior leadership on conflict prevention in the cyberspace. So prior to the UN, Neil served for over 15 years within the UK National Crime Agency, countering international organised crime and terrorism, including long-term postings in The Hague and Malta. I'd love to hear about Malta. Actually, that would be really interesting. And just as a bit of context as well, you're in Vienna at the minute, Neil, aren't you?
I am.
Happy days. Well, we're just around the corner in Germany here on the Christmas break. So that the you know, the internet doesn't have too far to travel, as we were talking before.
Obviously, I probably should have turned my VPN off before doing this, but hey.
I was wondering why you're coming up in Iceland, you know? No, I'm joking. Outside of work, Neil is married with four kids. He's an avid advocate for bowel cancer, brain hemorrhage, liver failure, osteoporosis, and pulmonary embolism awareness. And the reason why is because he survived all of these conditions himself. So as you can imagine, an unbelievable amount of ground for us to cover today. I'm trying to gallop through the intro here just to make sure that we make use of our time as best as possible. But today's episode is part of our collaboration with NI Connections, where we catch up with someone incredible from Northern Ireland who's doing really interesting things on the last Monday of every month. If you would like to discover more amazing diaspora stories like Neil's, you can check out the NI Connections website, which is where you can also sign up for their free monthly newsletter. So Neil, we've already kind of started in the, you know, the start of the hero's journey. You're in Glengormley, you're falling down the stairs. I know you went to school in North Belfast. We were introduced through a common, I'm going to say friend or a colleague at this point, Aidan Larkin, the Bitcoin auctioneer, as we kind of titled him whenever he was on the podcast. You guys went to the same school and there's a lovely kind of connection there. But I'd love to kind of know, like, crime and technology. When did you start getting interested in each of them separately or together as a package bundle? What were kind of your early interests like?
That's a great question. I think growing up in Belfast and in Northern Ireland, then there was the natural interest in crime and terror. I was born in 79 and went to school at St. Malachy's College just off Carlisle Circus in the 90s. And you know, back then, and much less, thank God, than it is now, but there was that continued threat of terrorism and that continued exposure to killings, to harm, to bombs. And I was in a bomb with my dad in Belfast's High Street, which I think I was 13. It was around 12, 13, and it was on a Saturday morning. And I was standing in a clothes shop when a bomb was placed on the roof of a police car, went off, glass everywhere, the loudest noise I've ever heard in my life. And that was a really defining moment for me, because we walked out of the shop, there were people lying critically injured in the street. I can still remember the smell. I can remember the echo, that ringing noise in my ear from the noise of the blast. And that was the moment where I decided I wanted to do something with my life that would try and stop stuff like that or counter stuff like that. And my original plan had to be, I wanted to be a trauma surgeon, like on a helicopter air ambulance. But my A-levels dictated a different path, which was when my biology exam was on plant biology and asked me to label the reproductive organs of a daffodil.
Yeah.
It suddenly became clear to me that I wasn't going to be a doctor. And actually, I wouldn't change a thing.
Mm. So where, just for a bit of context, where was it on the High Street?
Mm.
If you were to situate it today?
It was, there used to be a sort of like a police control bit just by Cornmarket. There used to be an Argos shop there years ago.
Yep, yep.
And there was a clothes shop in the corner, and I think it was a Burton's, but I can't remember exactly. And I was in that shop, and then there was the police control point where there was an unmarked car. But as those of you who have been in Northern Ireland in the 90s will remember that even though they were unmarked, they were clearly police cars. Mm. And it happened there.
Crazy. And so, you know, we talk about trauma, particularly now, you know, many years after those times and how that affects us. You know, that was very, very young. And it's amazing how you kind of did that Bruce Wayne thing where you turn it inwards and you make it a huge part of your story today. Mm. How did you move on from that at such a young age, even you and your father?
It was really surprising, because the noise of the bomb was enormous, and we left, you know, quite quickly the area. And I remember we walked down through Cornmarket and really paralleling High Street to go back to where the car was parked. And halfway along this street, people were still shopping normally. And I started to cry. And there was a woman, I still remember this really clearly, there was a woman stopped sort of in front of my dad and I and said, "Dry those tears, what are you crying about?" And my dad just lost it. He said, "A bomb has gone off around the corner, people are lying dead in the street." And it was just, it was that point where I noticed that despite the sound being so incredible for us, because of the position of the buildings, the way the blast had been dissipated, no one else had heard it, even, you know, 100 metres away, 100 yards away. So that was a real eye-opener. And it was that point where I thought, okay, what do you do about this? This isn't normal. This should never be normal. And I don't know, it was that sort of formative moment of where you've constantly heard this stuff on the news that you can either do something about it or complain about it. And I thought, well, I probably ought to try and do something about it.
Absolutely. And so you have that experience, you have that feeling, you have that, we'll call it a mission, because that's really what it is.
Yep.
It's very hard then as a young person to figure out what to do with that then. Because you can have all the gumption and all the passion and all the drive in the world, but how on earth do you go about starting to do that? Or how did you go about doing that?
So I started, I got really interested in psychology and criminal psychology, which is what I actually ended up doing at uni. But I started reading a load of books written by sort of retired FBI agents on criminal profiling, on investigations, on counterterrorism, things like that. It really, really piqued my interest. And then when the dreaded biology exam came up, thankfully I'd had a backup to medical school, which was to study psychology and criminology at a university called the University of Teesside in Middlesbrough. And thankfully I had the grades to get into that, and I'd been there for an open day, so I kind of knew where I was going, what I was getting into. And from having sort of read these books over the sort of 15, 16, 17-year-old, it had really started to expose me to a world that I hadn't really understood before. I'd seen the Northern Irish side of crime and terrorism, and I think really started to understand in my teenage years that terrorism, especially in Northern Ireland, was fundamentally based on the exploitation of people who had limited opportunities in their lives, in their ability to get work, their ability to grow themselves, and that those who were purporting to be their community leaders, whichever part of the town you lived in, were just exploiting and continuing to exploit. And that really started me down that path of trying to understand crime and why going into then studying psychology and criminology, and then eventually I did a master's in criminal investigation when I was working, really opened my eyes to different ways of looking at the world.
That is a unbelievably empathetic way of looking at crime.
I don't know. I really don't.
In terms of your family, like, tell me a little bit about your family, like, because particularly coming, you know, you as a victim of a act of terrorism,
I've never thought of it like, you know, that, but it's interesting.
Whenever you kind of lay it out, there's kind of two roads you see people go down. One is the often treaded bitter path, perhaps slightly revenge orientated, if not even explicitly. And then you seem to have gone on this other, much more compassionate road, which is not, to be honest, I'm surprised, because if you look at the bio and you think cybercrime and counterterrorism, you think quite of that heavy-handed sort of approach. But this is a surprise to me, and so I'd love to try to understand a bit more why.
Well, I've been incredibly lucky that despite the traumas in Northern Ireland in the 80s and the 90s, that my family directly were relatively untouched by it. Both my parents grew up in West Belfast, my mum just off the Falls Road, my dad off the Old Park Road, and they both grew up in relatively challenging circumstances and in areas where I think the risk of being dragged in to Republican violence or terrorism or mindset could have been really easy to happen. And I was really lucky to grow up. We lived in Glengormley for me as a kid, and to grow up with neighbours who were Catholic, Protestant, of all shapes and sizes. And I remember as a kid, I was out on my bike one day. I was probably around 10 or 11 years old. And there was a neighbour who we didn't know particularly well, but he was a bigger, older, sort of mid-teenage, grabbed me off my bike, sort of by my chest, and I'm a wee guy, right? I look like I'm really far away, but there's just not much to me. Bit of a Father Ted in that. But this teenager, he sort of lifted me by my chest and said, "Are you a Tig?" I had no idea what the hell he was asking me. I didn't know what the term meant. And I just sort of went, maybe, and got a punch in the head for that.
Oh, man.
But it was that sort of thing of, you know, when I tried to unpack that, when I said what happened to my parents, I just didn't get it. I just didn't get, why would, if you've grown up as Catholic, Protestant, Muslim, why the hell would that matter?
Yeah.
And, you know, I literally didn't get it. And I think I was a real... No, it's really unfortunate. It was a driving force for me leaving Northern Ireland that I made a conscious decision as a teenager that when if I had the opportunity to go to university that I would leave, and that I would, you know, I'd always wanted to go to London, which is where I'd applied for medical school. That didn't come off and I ended up in the northeast of England. But it was a real driving force behind me where I thought, wherever I end up in my life, if I end up ever having kids, I don't want them to grow up in a place where the first thing they're looking out for, or even unconsciously looking out for, is how did you pronounce the letter H or H? Mm. How do you spell something? Where are you? It doesn't matter. Yeah. It really doesn't matter.
So talk to me about Middlesbrough then. What was that transition like for you?
It was a fairly unexposed 18-year-old jumping onto the ferry in Belfast with my parents and going over to Middlesbrough a few days after my 18th birthday. And I'm an only child as well. My parents had a stillbirth when I was 6 years old and never had any more kids. So for them, that was a big shock to sort of go from having one kid in the house to suddenly having to talk to each other again. And it's, you know, as a father of four, the thought of when one of them or two of them leave home.
An empty nest? What is that?
I know. I can now, there's parts of it sound really attractive. There's other parts of it scare the hell out of me. So it's... You know, going to uni was
brilliant. It was the point where I think I grew up, and I know it's a bit of a cliche to say it, but to end up living in a house, a shared house in first year with 13 other sort of guys from around different parts of the country, making new friends, it really forced me to get out of my shell. I was really quite shy as a kid growing up. I was crap at sport, which was just, I was the kid who, when it came to picking the football team at school, I was going to be the one standing there at the end against the wall looking around going, oh shit, I'm on my own. Right. It's like, okay, who would like to have to put up with Neil sort of bimbling around in the corner, not able to do anything? So going to uni was the best thing I ever did. Leaving home in many ways was the best thing I ever did, because it forced me to grow up and sort of become whatever sort of a mess of an individual I've become now.
All those little shaping moments, they all contribute to the mess we are, aren't they? So give me kind of the highlight reel of your time at university. You've already talked about coming out of your shell. Any direction you want, whether it's academic or personal, what did uni really do for you?
I think it turned me into an adult. It made me able to talk to other people without feeling shy. It introduced me to this remarkable part of the population called women, which, going to an all boys Catholic grammar school in Belfast, it wasn't quite on the cards there that much. So, I made friends there who I am still in touch with today. That I still remember day one of uni being absolutely crapping myself of, how does this stuff work? How do you meet people? What do you do? And standing in a corridor outside a room where we had to go and register. And I remember there was a girl standing also on her own a little bit further away. And I thought, I'm going to go and talk to her. And it sort of worked up the courage to go up and say hello, and probably spoke in typically Northern Irish strong tones at a million miles an hour. But we're still friends now, and we spoke to each other on Christmas Eve. And it's that sort of thing. We made those formative friendships that have stayed. And, I had a girlfriend in first year and second year. And frankly, we probably should never have been boyfriend and girlfriend. We should have just been mates. But we're still in touch today. And, we still exchange Christmas cards and the odd WhatsApp at sort of birthdays. And it's that sort of thing which was really nice, just to build those friendships that have sort of sustained over the sort of following 20 odd years. But I think at uni I learned a lot about sort of the topics that I was studying. I found really, really interesting, focusing a lot on serial sexual offenders, especially the sort of serial killing and abuse of kids, which is something I dealt with a lot throughout my career and even now. And also just basic stuff like learning how to cook, learning how to look after yourself and survive in the world on your own, and finding that I was reasonably comfortable in my own space. And, it was really, I can't think of a better way to have experienced uni. There were some tough times in it. Despite being 5 foot nothing, I ended up being the head bouncer at the student union. I think the accent counted for a lot there.
Oh bro, I love that. No one wants to mess with a lad from Belfast, come on.
It was and I think I remember somebody who was really big who was fighting one night outside the union, and I walked over to him and they both stopped and they were like 6 foot five and I'm nothing, and I said, he must be really tough because he's tiny. And I was like, yeah, let's go with that. That sounds like a great way to say it.
Man, so
but it's all of those things that make you grow and turn you into the person that you want to be, make career decisions from there, and on it went. But it was a town that, Middlesbrough itself was a town with real socioeconomic challenges. Mm. It was going through some really tough times in the late 90s through job losses around it from used to be an ICI chemical plant, which is what the town was essentially built upon. And just seeing how a town like that, which had a lot of similarities to Belfast, sort of grew, how it dealt with its own challenges. And for me, coming to understand living in a town where you weren't seeing cops and army vehicles heavily armed around all day, that was a really big psychological shift for me. And it gave me some new opportunities, new ways of thinking about things.
Wow. So then you eventually make it to London, the place where your sights were initially
the
set
big
on.
Big shiny lights. Yeah. So I applied for a load of different jobs sort of across the civil service when I was, I'd always said to my dad, my mum and dad were civil servants throughout their career, and I'd sworn from day one I would never end up as a civil servant, and of course then went down exactly that path. I'd wanted to be a cop, but when I was 15, I'd slipped a disc in my lower back doing PE at school. And then I admitted that on the application form to the Metropolitan Police and got rejected on medical grounds, which was gutting. But actually, it was, everything turned out okay. I ended up joining an organisation that doesn't exist anymore called the National Criminal Intelligence Service, which then went on to become the Serious Organised Crime Agency, which then is what it is now, the National Crime Agency.
So what happened first? You go into The Hague or Malta, or you turning 26?
I 26. So I joined, let's call it the NCA and its predecessors, when I was 21. And so I was based in London for 10 years before the foreign postings came up. But yes, I was 5 years into my career in London when I was 26.
And what happened? Why is 26 an important year for you?
It was the 10th of May, 2006. It was a Wednesday. It was very sunny. It was a beautiful day. I was living in Hertfordshire at the time, in a town called Welwyn Garden City.
Lovely.
And I'd been to the doctor a few times in the previous few months, and I'd been having blood when I was going to the loo. And I'd had blood coming out of my bum over the past 5 years, on and off. I'd been to the doctor way back at the start of this. She looked at me with some contempt and said, "You're 21, 22, go away. There's nothing wrong with you." And then over the next few years, I started to bleed a lot more. But in my head, I'd heard a doctor say, "There's nothing wrong." So I ignored it. I thought, "Oh, maybe I've got piles or hemorrhoids because I'm in the gym every day. I'm lifting weights." And I ignored it. Turned out I had rectal cancer, and that was diagnosed on the 10th of May 2006, where a fairly happy-go-lucky doctor, because I'd been through some treatment to try and fix the non-existent hemorrhoids, which strangely enough hadn't worked, and got sent to the hospital by my GP, who said, "Nothing to worry about, they're going to just go and see the doctor just to be checked out there a bit more thoroughly." This doctor put a small camera up my bum and said, "Do you mind if my medical student joins me? This is how they learn." I said, "Yeah, of course, crack on." Expecting sort of this sort of big hairy ass guy to walk in. Of course, this stunningly beautiful 22-year-old girl walks in.
Always the way.
Absolutely stunning. As I'm sort of, I don't mind being naked in front of a doctor, but being naked from the waist down whilst wearing a shirt and tie on the top is just weird. So he's having a good look using this camera called a rigid sigmoidoscope, which is pleasant as the name suggests. And the medical student was with him, and I heard him say, "Can you see it?" And I thought, well, either the way I'm lying, one of my balls has poked out the back, sorry guys, or there's something critically wrong here. And in my head, I knew straight away, I have cancer. There is something dangerously wrong here.
Just by the tone, or what gave it away?
By the tone, the fact that he said, "Can you see it?" Wow. And then I thought, okay, I've been bleeding for years now. There is something wrong here. And so he took the camera out. I got fully dressed again. And he'd gone from being fairly happy-go-lucky to being really serious. Mm. And he said, "Okay, there is," he said, "I found a tumor, a mass in your rectum. We need to examine that really quickly to see what's going on." He said, "I don't know what it is, but I need you to have a colonoscopy in the next few days, and to do some CT scans quite soon as well." And he gave me an envelope and said, "Take this envelope over to that office over there," pointing out the window, "and come back and tell me what date they've given for the colonoscopy. I will do it myself."
Wow.
And me, being sort of 5 years into a law enforcement career, immediately opened the envelope outside the room and saw probable stage 3 rectal cancer. I was like, shit.
Oh my goodness.
That's not very good. And so life changed at that point. And over the next few months, through lots of examinations and sort of smaller operations, we identified I was very lucky. I had a stage 1 cancer, which is the lowest grade in my rectum. So if you feel like you need to go to the loo, in that bit. And I had to have my rectum, the descending part of my sigmoid colon, all removed. I had to have a stoma, an ileostomy or a bag for 6 months, and then have that reconnected to my intestine to make it work again. And so that was the start, but unfortunately not the end of my cancer experience.
Mm. How long before you're next?
It was 12 years before the next. So my sort of intestinal habit was really screwed up after the surgery, because I'd gone from having a full large intestine to having around about 2/3 of it left. Okay. And it didn't recover very well. It struggled to recover, which is quite common. Things got a little bit better over 5 years, but in that time, got married, and my girlfriend then wife, who was with me at the start of this journey, you know, she went through a hell of a lot, because I was physically in a mess where, you know, I could be on the loo for 12 hours a day whilst also working. And most of it was at nighttime, so I'd have really little sleep. And trying to manage a normal life through that became challenging. So it's still amazing that we're still together. Because she stuck with it despite the fact that I was a physical and probably something of an emotional mess as well. But things got better, and I was really lucky that with work I was posted to The Hague, organisation called Europol, the EU's law enforcement agency. Sadly, the UK is no longer a full part of that, but there we are. At least you got your sovereignty back, but ended up in The Hague for 4.5 years. Kept getting checked up there. I had an annual colonoscopy and scans to make sure the cancer hadn't returned or spread. Everything was fine. And then I ended up in hospital in 2014 in The Hague, because suddenly my intestines got stuck together in scar tissue, had to have an emergency operation where they opened my abdomen up again and sort of tucked things back together and unhooked them. No sign of cancer. Everything was fine. Then I got moved to Malta after that, and we'll come back to that. But my next cancer was diagnosed completely out of the blue 2 years ago, 2018, where just a routine annual colonoscopy found that I had managed to grow in the period of a year a fairly decent tumour in my descending colon, which had penetrated the outside of the colon but thankfully hadn't spread to the lymph nodes or any other organs. But that meant that I then had, I've had almost all of my large intestine removed. I've got around 50, 60 centimetres of it left, and a lot of my small intestine removed as well. So that, again, comes with some really unpleasant consequences. During that surgery, I had multiple brain hemorrhages, had heart failure in intensive care, had to have resuscitation. Then over the next couple of years to where we are now, I've developed Crohn's disease and colitis, which are inflammatory bowel diseases. And also I had multiple pulmonary embolisms, blood clots in the lungs that are very commonly fatal. So really, I mean, in intensive care, they started referring to me as Lazarus because I wouldn't die. So it was it's kind of cool still to be sitting here talking to you, because there are so many occasions in the recent past where I should be dead.
And I'm going to, like, this is kind of lazy interviewing on my part, but it's where I want to go. I'm literally just going to repeat the question that I asked you at the start.
Yeah.
You know, about the bomb. Again, you've two paths in front of you whenever you're faced with such life-altering situations like you've just described.
Yep.
You move forward or you move back. Like, what have you done that has enabled you to keep moving forward? Or what is it that's at least even given you the motivation to do that? Because I think that's so key.
It would be incredibly easy to get into bed, cover your head with the duvet and say, screw that, I've had enough of this. And I'm really lucky. I think part of it is because of growing up in Belfast, I've seen what other people have been exposed to. And no matter what I've gone through, it has been nothing compared to what people who have been victims of terrorism or the associated organised crime have been through. As a law enforcement officer for 15 years, I've interviewed suspects, I've interviewed victims who have been through the most horrendous of traumas, that everything I've been through is like the common cold. So that, I think that for me was, every time that I'm allowed to stay alive, I've got to make the best of that. That's what I've got to be able to do. I can't just sit back and say, meh, it's a bit of a tough day, I'm not gonna do anything about it. So that's really kept me focused. And for a large amount of my career, I dealt with countering online child sexual abuse, which often meant dealing with some really horrendous crimes where very, very young babies under the age of 6 months, where I was seeing videos of them being raped or violated online, having to deal with that. And because of that work, I had regular access to a psychologist. Oh God, if she ever hears this, Dr. Noreen Tehrani has saved my life many times over, because she gave me the coping techniques and the ability to deal with high levels and continued levels of stress. And that's something I was exposed to throughout my law enforcement career. I worked on the September 11th inquiry in the US with the FBI, dealing with the fallout of that in the UK and making critical decisions on terrorism casework night after night, day after day as a 23, 24-year-old. So all of that gave me the techniques, the coping techniques, to then, whenever cancer happened the first time and then the life changes that go around that, and then the second time, where I'm very lucky so far, touch wood, I've been able to keep on going.
So interesting. I remember reading a few years ago, it was like an opinion piece, goodness knows where it was, and it was talking about, you know, the people that work for big social media companies that work on the filtering department. I'm botching the technicalities, but you'll get the drift. And you know, these individuals are just sitting there day after day going through really explicit or abusive content to make sure it doesn't make it into the, you know, the main feed. And I just walked away from that. Like, I just was thought, like, how do you deal with that as an individual? And in some ways, that is exactly what you've had to deal with. So what were some of those coping mechanisms that the psychologist was able to lead you down?
So there's some ways where you can minimize risk to those who are exposed to it. Some of it is understanding the psychology of how one's brain will analyze and take that in. For me, I actually end up, my primary coping mechanism is that I compartmentalize things. Mm-hmm. And that for me is really effective. It doesn't work for everybody. And you've got to understand, I think you've got to have a really clear understanding of your own risks. And that sort of understanding, where do I feel I am at most risk? Because when I started child abuse work, it was when my first child, she was only 6 months old. So the psychologist was explaining to me some of the stuff that you're seeing when you are washing your daughter or changing her nappy. You might get a flashback you might get an intrusive image comes into your head because of that. Here is what you have to do to cope with that. Wow. And that's basically what I've used ever since, which is where I can... There are things that will trigger it as well. For example, there's an implement in everybody's kitchen that I used to find incredibly difficult to look at because I'd seen that being used to sexually harm a child. Mm-hmm. And even seeing that device, which is in everybody's kitchen, really, I even talking about it now, I can feel the hair in the back of my neck standing up. But I went through that process of how I can rationalize that, how I can put it into this box, which I physically feel on the top left-hand side of my head. That's where I store all the bad stuff. And physically imagine this being put into a box, the lid being closed and a lock being put on it. And if that lid starts to bulge, then I know that I'm reaching a point where I need to deal with whatever is causing stress or challenge in my life. And I'm lucky that that hasn't really happened. So it's about understanding that threat. It's about trying to, especially if one is exposed to child abuse continually, you have to try and dehumanize it, which is very difficult to do, but it's trying to dehumanize it, because if you actually think of the reality and get stuck in the reality of what's going on, you'd break. You'd break straight away. And there are cases that do that. But fundamentally, it's about looking at the offence. It's about looking at, for example, there are techniques that reduce the exposure of those investigators to seeing the face of the victim, which is really impactful on reducing the harm. If you don't see the face, you don't see the trauma behind it as much. So there's ways of doing that. There's also technological ways that reduce the amount of exposure that those who are assessing the material have. But it's a horrible bloody job, and those who have to do it for social media companies or in NGOs who try and remove content or block content on the internet, it is incredibly difficult, and they are many of the unsung heroes in our society that keep us safe.
And that is such a good point. You know, the heroes, or the role of the hero in society, has changed just as exponentially as the technology that we experience in our day-to-day lives, you know? Because you were naturally drawn to that role of a cop, because that's the archetype hero, or, you know, part of a hero that you understand, or you want to be a fireman, or you want to be boots on the ground, or you want to put on the bat costume and, you know, go and be
I'm an adrenaline junkie. I admit that. I have an addiction to adrenaline.
And here you are now, operating in those roles, but in a very, very new, fast-paced space. And I just would love to know, like, what does your day-to-day look like now at the United Nations?
Bloody chaotic. I mean, as I look, what does day-to-day look like right now? I'm in my 10-year-old daughter's bedroom, which looks like a crime scene, frankly. And it's... So we've been on lockdown since March of last year. I've been in the office a handful of times since then. And my job until a year ago, Matt, was I would spend probably 2 weeks away from home every week for the year. I would travel 300,000 kilometres in the air each year. And most of my role is, it's kind of twofold. So my staff, who have backgrounds in policing, criminal justice, intelligence, international relations, their job is to help cops, prosecutors, judges to build their capability to counter cybercrime, which is crime committed on or via or using the internet. And there's a whole host of things that can be in that. And my job sort of started off with that when I joined the UN. I saw the job advertised. I didn't know anybody in the UN, didn't know anything about it, applied for it, didn't think I would get anywhere, and bizarrely, here I am. But I started just being, there was me and half a member of staff. But thankfully, you know, we're an extra budgetary part of the UN, so we're only funded entirely by governments who give us money. So it's kind of like I have to stand outside the governmental equivalent of Tesco rattling a tin to get money into it to keep people in a job and to allow us to do what we do. So I started, and it's almost, where are we now, the 6th of January. So it is exactly 6 years since I've started when we're recording this. And sorry, 5 years. I count correctly? 2016. Yeah, 5 years. And this is the start of my 6th year. And we've gone from being me and half a member of staff to now having 70-odd staff, a budget of $50-odd million a year, because we've been able to grow and we're good at what we do. And so I've moved on from delivering that training to cops because, firstly, I was able to do it really well when I just left law enforcement. I had the credibility from having done that job. But now, being away from being a cop for over 5 years now, then I start to lose, I think I lose the edge of running investigations because techniques and tradecraft have moved on, whereas I've been out of that. So I've got better people to do that around me. And my job now is preventive diplomacy, of trying to stop conflict between countries based on things that happen in cyberspace, where countries might do things against each other, where we're trying to de-risk where they might start some sort of conflict. It might be a covert conflict. It might go all the way through to the worst case scenario of being a predicate to a war. So that's my job on a day-to-day basis now, is to try to minimize those risks. And most of that, unsurprisingly, is through talking. It might be that I'm talking with the Americans, the Russians, the Chinese, the South Africans. It could be any country on earth. And it's to try and understand their positioning, to try and understand what they're seeking to achieve, to try and find areas of consensus where they will agree upon, and then try and help to reduce risk. It won't ever take it away, but it will reduce things. And everything we do, Matt, I think in every job and every walk of life depends on relationships and our ability to manage relationships. And for all of us, you know, anybody listening to this, 2020 as a year for managing relationships was crap, because most of us couldn't travel anywhere. We couldn't meet people. And I've seen that really impact in diplomacy, in politics, and in policy generally, where I'd normally be traveling around the world, meeting people, understanding their positions, trying to help them find solutions, to where we're doing everything either on Microsoft Teams or Zoom. And you can kind of manage relationships that are pre-existing online, but trying to establish new ones and build that trust, where often that trust can only be built if you're sitting with someone, look them in the eye, see their body language, go for dinner with them, empathize with them because you see the reality of their lives. That's reduced significantly, almost disappeared. And it's the same as in our normal lives, right? We might be, those of you who are single and have been in lockdown on your own, I can imagine how difficult that was. Those of you who have a partner and were locked up with them, you might have found that significantly difficult as well. So I think because our world has changed significantly, I have seen risk growing enormously in this period. I've seen organized criminal groups, terrorist groups, states taking hostile actions that they wouldn't have taken last year because the relationships that kept that in check have either disappeared or significantly reduced.
So interesting. You know, even in a hyper, you know, digital world, how so much of it is still like dependent on that face-to-face.
Absolutely.
It's really,
absolutely,
really interesting. I really enjoyed that. But what is the threat?
What is the threat? What a bloody good question. It is constantly changing and it evolves at pace. So I'll give you some figures which are horrendously disturbing. I've spoken a little bit about child abuse already online. And just for any of you listening to this who have been a victim of this, and there will be those of you because of the prevalence of it, please do something about that. You will be believed if you approach the police, if you approach non-governmental organisations or charities in this space. There are people who will listen to you, who will be able to help you through that experience, even if it is a very long time ago. So please don't feel that you are alone. And the reason I say that is we work very closely with the internet industry, with non-governmental organisations. And for example, one of them is called the National Centre for Missing and Exploited Children. It's based in Washington in the US. And their job is to receive tips and referrals from Facebook, Google, the US-based companies when they find child abuse material on their platforms. And just to be clear, child abuse is anywhere from under the age of 18 down. And some of this, what we're seeing now is this in 2020, by the end of Q3, quarter three of 2020, this National Centre, NCMEC, as we call it, had received over 60 million referrals of child abuse material from the industry in the US. 60 million, which is more than they received in the entirety of 2019. And that's just one organisation receiving these referrals. This is mirrored with other organisations around the world. In the UK, you have the Internet Watch Foundation. There's 40-odd other organisations around the world that gather this intelligence and evidence as well. So the amount of material is enormous. People often think, oh, child abuse, it's awful, but it must be quite small. It's not. There is a significant proportion of adults that have a sexual interest in children. And my appeal to any of you, for example, if you have been on a porn site and you have seen something where you think, that doesn't look like an adult, if you think it looks like a child, and I'm not talking, are they 18, 19, I'm talking 18 and below, if it looks like a child, do something about that. You do not have to go to the police. You can report anonymously. So I encourage you, go onto Google, search for the Internet Watch Foundation and click on their reporting portal. All you have to do is copy in the hyperlink, the address that you found this material in. You don't have to give an email address, no contact details, nothing. No one will contact you. But you can report that, and they are really efficient at getting this material taken down rapidly. Because every time that material is viewed, that child is victimized again. And there is a real person on the end of this, and we have to help manage that enormous risk. We then look at the more evolving risks brought by COVID. You can guarantee, I haven't actually looked recently, but now that vaccines are coming online, you will see an enormous amount of fake or fraudulent vaccines will be offered for sale on the internet, be it on the open internet or on the dark net, the hidden part of the internet, where you need special software to access it. Because criminals are seeking to make money from the pandemic, and they're very, very efficient at making money. They don't have the red tape and the bureaucracy to jump through that law enforcement or policymakers do. They can move at pace, and they will seek to exploit what they can. And this brings me back to my formative years in Belfast. Organised criminals and terrorists exploit. Yeah. They exploit opportunities. They exploit power vacuums. They exploit economic damage. And that's what really worries me now, because during the pandemic, globally, we have seen a reduction in the number of specialised law enforcement officers because they've been redirected to other duties, maybe quarantine enforcement or other work. We have seen court systems stop working. We have seen referrals of child abuse material increasing enormously, but the ability to do something about that has dropped off because if you're working from home, having to assess child abuse material and you're not there on your own, how do you do that safely? So the time starts to drop off. So there is a perfect storm of criminality happening right now where the threat is increasing, the responses are decreasing, and the public are in many ways unaware of this. So basically my message around that is, if you're offered a vaccine online, if it feels too good to be true, it is. Mm. If someone is offering you something for sale and saying, hey, here's the solution, there is a secret conspiracy trying to stop you get access to this vaccine, it's not true. They are seeking to exploit you. So please think really carefully before you take a decision to buy something or to take something that's not come from your GP.
There are so many different directions I'd love to go. There's so many questions I'd love to ask you, some of which I'm not sure if you could answer in your...
Ask whatever you like, I just mightn't be able to answer it.
But I tell you, I think the fastest way to get there and the easiest way to get around some of that stuff is, it's twofold, okay? What digital policy do you have in your own house with your children?
Great question. So all of the kids, they have... So I've got four kids and they're aged 10, 8, 6 and 4.
Okay.
You can see what happened every 2 years. it's...
They started sleeping through the night and you're like, I think we could have another one. Oh, no.
I have never thought that, but my wife had, my wife got me in the moment of weakness three other times. So I did very much what I was... No, I'm really lucky. I mean, I've got four brilliant, amazing kids who have coped with the madness of being moved countries routinely, with me being away regularly. And, you know, between my wife and my kids, they deserve a medal, frankly, for putting up with me, because I am generally a bit of an ass. So they've had to cope with way too much. But how the kids, what we do digitally, they have tablets, which we have locked down as tight as we can, that they can, for example, they can watch cartoons, or they have games or apps that we have decided what they can put on to that, that we've put those on it.
Do you use the inbuilt screen lock parental controls? Yep, okay.
Yep, use that. And then my 10-year-old is... So schooling is a little bit different here than it is to the UK. So schooling starts later in Austria. So she started first year, so the very first year of primary school, aged 6, which was her third year of doing the first year of primary school, because she also did the first year in Malta and she's the first year in the Netherlands, because they start at different ages. But now that they're on lockdown, she has a mobile, she has WhatsApp, but on the mobile, I have locked it down fully, so it is tied to my account. Mm-hmm. She can't download apps. She can't access Google or the internet. She can only do the school-based stuff on that. Now, I'm conscious that that will change, and there will come a point that that changes. And the key point in all of this is about empowering our kids. Scaring them doesn't work, mm-hmm. right? You remember when you were a kid, your parents said, don't do that. And you thought, I might try doing that. So it's about empowering them and explaining, here are what the risks look like.
Yeah.
And especially with the stuff that I've dealt with in my past, it's explaining what is something appropriate? What does consent mean? And you can explain consent from the youngest of ages. So if my 3 recently turned 4-year-old, if she's in the shower and I'm saying, okay, listen, I need to wash your bum, is that okay? Mm-hmm. We've already got into a consent-based conversation because I've asked, and she understands that I've asked. And or if I say, could I have a cuddle? And she says, no, then that's fine. Mm-hmm. And it's these sort of things where we help our kids to understand consent from the youngest of ages, what appropriate conversations are. And, you know, something I took from victims regularly was when they were being victimized, they didn't know what to say. They didn't know how to talk about it. So trying to get rid of taboos, mm-hmm. and trying to get rid of, you know, something really important, for example, is they understand how to talk about their own bodies,
yeah.
appropriately, not using sort of pet names for their genitals, not being embarrassed to say penis, vulva, vagina, anus. If they know what it's called, then God forbid if something happens, they know how to tell you what's gone on.
Yeah.
And you build that trusting conversation of saying, whatever happens at any point in your life, if you need me, I'm there for you. You call me, I come and get you. I'm not going to be angry. I'll listen and I'll help you to sort it out. Mm. And, you know, my dad always said that to me and it's always stuck with me. So that comes into the digital age as well, where if you find something on a site that maybe you shouldn't be on, or you've done something which is high risk, and, for example, half the child abuse content, 50% of the child abuse content online now is self-generated. Mm. It's kids from the age of 10, 11, 12 taking nude or semi-nude selfies right the way up to masturbating online on a camera and posting it. Mm-hmm. So we have to be talking about consent and understanding boundaries and what feels right and what's wrong and helping them through that.
Absolutely. And I really like how you've struck the balance between, I don't know how to word this exactly, giving your kids the freedom to explore certain parts of,
yep,
you know, technology, because it's in the fabric of our daily lives now, and it will be for their jobs, yep, and their
social, absolutely,
life. But then also giving them the freedom from certain risks and certain,
correct,
things that they you've taken the burden off them at this, you know, at each stage of their life, which I think is really important. The last, yep, kind of wee bit that I'd love to cover before starting to land the plane. Anything that you would advise us to do as listeners to keep ourselves safe? So you've talked about, you know, what you do with your kids. What do you do for yourself, for example, knowing everything that you know? What are some best practices that we can implement, sure, in our own digital lives or otherwise?
So you can't prevent everything, right? We have to get away from a culture of criticizing people if a mistake happens. The most common vector for criminals trying to make money out of us, we are the commodity, is you will receive one of those emails of you've won the lottery or your Microsoft account is about to expire. Please click on this link. These are fictitious, okay? These are criminals trying to monetize you. And that might be to gain access to your device, to gain access to your bank account, to gain access to your data. You are the commodity. And people will often say, I hear this routinely, well, I've got nothing to hide, so I don't care. Mm. And if you're of that position, well, I've got nothing to hide, they can take whatever they wish, you are the best person for them to target, because there are so many things you can do with someone's data. It could be applying for a driving license, a bank account, getting involved in all sorts of criminality. So really, partially, we have to think through, sometimes we do things because of greed, where an offer is presented to us that is clearly too good to be true and nothing happens, where you want to buy the car that you've always wanted and you find it on eBay at a tenth of the price that it ought to be, and they're asking for you to pay through Western Union or another money transfer business. And, you know, if you have that spider sense tingling in your chest, in your tummy, in the back of your head, something is wrong. Listen to your body. Don't do that. But if you have made a mistake, reach out for help. There's lots of people who can help you and try and minimize that risk. And I was doing this with a colleague just yesterday who is based in another part of the world, has probably been a subject to a significant five-figure fraud. And these things happen all the time. So it's about, you can minimize some of the technological risks, but all of the risks are primarily human and they are emotional. Anything that happens, be it through, you know, we've all seen the COVID misinformation of it's a conspiracy or they're injecting, I don't know, some sort of chip in the vaccine. What a load of crap. I mean, it's utter nonsense. And if we take ourselves out of the horribly pressured environment of lockdown, if we heard this stuff any other time, we'd think, that's just crazy. Why would I believe that? So we've got to remove the emotion, because criminals, fraudsters, they will use the pressure of emotion, the pressure of time to try and exploit. And all of these things will come with a pressure of time. You must do this now, otherwise consequence ABC will happen. If it's something really horrible, like you've met someone on a dating site and maybe they're saying, let's take this off the site and go private, be really careful if you're at that point. Look to have that as an established relationship before you do that, where you actually know who each other is, because there is lots of exploitation around that. Basic things that you can do is take a real judgment. Again, if you're using a dating site and you start to get into a path of doing something sexual online, think of the risk around that. I'm not saying don't do it. I'm just saying think of the risk. Are you 100% sure who you are dealing with? Do you know that individual directly? Do you know where they are, who they are? Because if you don't, the risk of what you do online being recorded and then monetized or used against you to try and extort you is really rather high. So you can do basic things like covering your camera, turning the camera off, putting a bit of tape over it. But all of that, it comes back to human beings making decisions. So think critically about the decisions you make. I put my hand up as I'm one of the worst ones, made decisions at pace where I've got it wrong. And we all do that. So it's trying to always remember that anything we do, we are in control. You are in control. It is not the person on the other end of that email, that video call, that WhatsApp message. You decide what you do, when and how. The power will always be with you.
It's brilliant. Couple of stock questions then. I'm very disappointed we didn't get to Malta.
It's a lovely place. Go and visit it.
Okay. I had an open tab in my head and it was really annoying me. I was like, gotta close the loop. Come on. There's a kind of a series of stock questions that we always wrap up. First one for this kind of series. How have you seen Northern Ireland change over the years? As broad as that.
Anyway, you want to take it? I remember I, with my girlfriend, who shouldn't have been my girlfriend at uni, I brought her back to Northern Ireland at the end of first year, and we went visiting sort of around the coast and then into Donegal, and we came back in through Omagh, the town of Omagh, the day before the Omagh bomb went off.
Jeez Louise, and you know how to pick it, like.
I know, I've got the body of a 95-year-old and the decision-making of a 3-year-old. But we ended up there and all the horrendous stuff that happened as a result of that. But I remember being in Belfast, which was still really sort of, mid-90s. Belfast was the Belfast that I grew up in. I haven't been in Northern Ireland in 2020 because of the pandemic. So I haven't been back since the summer of 2019. But every time I go back and I go into Belfast, it's just everything has changed. It's much more cosmopolitan. It's much more, restaurants have changed, shops have changed. It worries me the effect economically of the pandemic on the city and on the country generally. But I've just seen it grow up and mature and become this beautiful, outward-facing city and country that, frankly, it wasn't when I was a kid.
It's brilliant. Does it have a future in cyber, do you think?
Yes, absolutely. I think the opportunities for tech sector growth, and I've seen a number of bits like this around Northern Ireland, are really strong. I think you've got a young, well-educated, empathetic population, and within that is the basis for any good economic growth. And I hope that, despite my personal view, of course, I think Brexit is really unfortunate in so many ways. I hope that the economic harms caused by that are as minimized as possible, because that combined with COVID is a horrendous economic situation to face. But I think the infrastructure that exists in Northern Ireland, the growth of Northern Ireland over the past 10-15 years, is remarkable. So yes, without doubt, there is a cyber tech sector growth capability there, and you've seen some major companies investing, and I really hope that continues to happen.
Most successful moment so far?
Waking up every day. That basic.
If you could take anyone from Northern Ireland, dead or alive, out for a pint or a cup of coffee, who would you take, where would you take them, and why?
Oh my God, I wish you'd prepped me for that one. Anybody from Northern Ireland? I tell you what, someone I haven't seen for a while, but I've done some work with, is a journalist called Deborah McAleese, who's on BBC, used to be with the Belfast Telegraph. I owe her a drink stroke dinner, and we've never done it. So, Deborah, if you hear this, whenever I finally make it back there, we'll go out and do that.
Where are you going to go?
I don't know, because I don't know what's current, if that makes any sense. I don't know, maybe it's going to be McDonald's at Castle Court. I hope it'll be slightly nicer than that.
Why not?
I'm open to offers. You tell me, Matt. Where should I go?
Yeah, I'll and whenever it's happening, send me a wee message. I'll give you 4 or 5 places that will be well up your street.
All right.
look, final question, because we're at the end of our time here. And This is the question we always end with. And so we've got here in the end, okay? We did all right.
What's this going to be?
If you could go back into some sort of time machine and you're given the clause that the world won't implode, you know, there's no butterfly effect, you're not going to damage the fabric of the space-time continuum. That's off your shoulders, okay? But you could go back to,
thanks, man.
Say, an 18-year-old version of yourself, perhaps on the ferry over to Middlesbrough or wherever the port is that connected you to Middlesbrough.
It was Hesham, I think. Hesham. No, it was Scotland, it was Cairn Ryan.
There you go.
Cairn Ryan, then a long drive.
And you had a few minutes, you know, you could walk over to Neil, who's looking out over the water or eating some food or whatever it is, and you had a couple of minutes of his time. What would you say to him?
It's okay to say no. It's okay to say you don't have to do everything for everybody all the time. And it's probably one of my biggest flaws now is my, I'm still trying to learn how to do it, that to say no to something, if someone says, can you do X, Y, or Z, there comes a point where you say, no, there is not enough of me left to do that. Mm. And I think that took me a very long time to come to terms with. I think imposter syndrome exists for everybody. We don't think we're doing good enough at our jobs, at our lives, at our careers. It's all right. It's all right to be just where you are right now. So don't stress. The world will continue to turn. Like you say, there's no butterfly effect. We just keep going, be chilled, come to terms with who you are. It took me until my mid-30s to come to terms with who I am. And, you know, not to want to be or feel that I was competing for something else. And I think once you're able to do that, then life becomes remarkably easier.
That's brilliant. And I'd just like to add, you know, there's a lot of action steps to take after today's episode. I think Neil's covered some really, really amazing ground, both on kind of the softer side, but then even some of the more personal side as well, where if you have been affected by anything that Neil talked about today, I think that reassurance that he gave, where there is a huge amount of support available, there's many, many people who are not only willing to listen, but are eager for you to reach out. And so I just want to underscore that and encourage you to do so if that's something that you need to do. Also, just want to say thank you very much for spending this time with us. Like I said at the start, this is Best of Belfast. We have done over 170 conversations, not quite like this one, but certainly with 170 interesting people from Northern Ireland. Big thank you to NI Connections for making this episode possible. We're doing a series of diaspora stories, reaching out to incredible people like Neil from Northern Ireland who are doing remarkable things all around the world. You can find out more at niconnections.com. You can sign up to their monthly newsletter to find out and be introduced to all these amazing individuals once a month. And you can also check out our back catalogue where we have interviewed, I think you're our 7th diaspora story, Neil, officially. So it's a nice round, perfect number. And I just want to say, honestly, dude, really, really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much for everything you shared. It was absolutely unbelievable.
It's my pleasure, Matt. I appreciate the invitation to NI Connections and also to those of you who have taken the time to listen. Thanks to let me into your home today.
And I'm glad you said yes to this. Every time I hear people say, like, oh, you know, like saying no is something I'm really trying to prioritize, I'm like, oh man, I feel so grateful that this was a yes.
It's my pleasure. It really is my pleasure to get the opportunity to do this. I mean, I'm just a kid from North Belfast.